Hello and welcome to the podcast from the Foundation for Science and Technology. This week, we're discussing the science of sleep, circadian rhythms, the experience of shift workers and cultural norms when it comes to getting rest. With me to discuss that is Dr. Katharina Ledoux, sleep therapist and author of Sleep Sense. Dr. Ledoux, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, really looking forward. Thank you for inviting me. Looking forward to our chat.
Well, let's start with something really basic, trying to understand what sleep actually is. And most of us will have heard of things like circadian rhythms, but can you explain what these are and how they work?
Yeah, sure. So sleep and circadian rhythms are slightly different, but related things. So starting at the top, we have a body clock, which sits up in your brain, and it's an area sort of, quite in the middle. And this clock sets the rhythm for all the different processes that happen within your body. And one of these processes or rhythms is the rhythm of sleep and wake. And the body clock is one part that regulates our sleep behavior in the sense it sets the timing. And you may have noticed sort of within your family, within your friendship group, that some people talk about larks, sort of they want to go to bed early, wake up early. And then the other extremists, the owls, they want to go to bed late, wake up late, typically teenagers. And the rest of us, we fall somewhere sort of along this spectrum. And that's your body clock. And this sleep behavior that repeats every 24 hour. That's the name circadian, almost 24, almost a day, right? As I say, sleep is slightly different. Sleep is a biological process, a natural process. Here comes the big surprise that we cannot control. Quite the opposite. The more we try to control, and I see this a lot with my insomnia clients, the more we try to control our sleep, actually, the further that sleep goes away. So it's a natural process we quite naturally engage in.
And just help me out from a sort of a biological sense. We all know a good night's sleep is essential for productive and efficient day the following day. We also know if you don't get a full night's sleep, you have the reverse problem. But why? I mean, why does the amount of sleep that we get affect us in this way?
Mm-hmm. So it's the amount and it's the quality. And what research is actually discovering sort of or has over the last few years that it might be that quality matters more than quantity. That's not to say it's okay if you only have 5 hours or 4 hours on a continuous basis, by no means. But it's certainly an interplay, and maybe the quality is actually a little bit more important. Anyhow, coming back to your question about, why this amount? So how much sleep a person needs, that's really down to the individual. It depends on age, it depends on sex, and so on and so forth, healthy, unhealthy. But we say sort of generally an adult needs between 7 and 9 hours per night. And there is, like I said, variation. And when we sleep, it's not like we switch off our brain, not at all. The brain is still very active and we can measure brain waves. And based on these brain waves, we can say a person is awake or asleep. And then when we sleep, the brain waves, they keep changing cyclically. And that reflects the different sleep stages we go through. And very broadly speaking, we have light sleep, deep sleep, and REM sleep or rapid eye movement sleep, sort of called the dream sleep in common language. And we cycle through these three again and again and again and again. Now, what's happening also is that in the first half of the night, proportionally speaking, we have more deep sleep. And in the second half of the night, we have more of the REM sleep, of the sort of vivid dreaming, right? And so we need sort of that shift. We need the right proportion of each sleep stage in order to wake up feeling refreshed, right? To be ready for the day.
And you used the word earlier, quality. And I'm just sort of interested when you say quality of sleep rather than quantity, what does that actually mean in terms of what we need?
That's a very good question and really tricky to answer. That quality, what makes a good quality sleep, a good quality night? It's hard to measure. Sure, we have some sort of, scales that we can use, measurement systems. But people will answer it slightly different because we all have our own sort of standard against which we're measuring a night. And again, that will be influenced by lots of different factors. But for me, when clients ask me, how much sleep do I need and so on and so forth, a good indicator is how do you feel when you wake up? And I don't mean necessarily the moment you wake up, because there's this thing called sleep inertia or sleep grogginess. We have some people, they wake up, and I fall in that group, wake up and we're ready to go, right? And then there are other people, they wake up, they've had the sleep they need, but they're still, when they wake up, they're a bit groggy, they're not sort of really fully there yet. They take half an hour, sometimes it can take 2 hours until they're really sharp, right? But once you've reached that level of sharpness, let's say, just check in, you know, do I feel refreshed? Can I go throughout the day without relying on, you know, an hour or 2 hour long nap, without relying on 5 cups of coffee? You know, can I do the things that I want to do while I feel good within myself? Then, if that's the case, then you know you've had good quality sleep and also the right amount of sleep.
Well, let's talk about some of the variations across people. One of the variations is gender. You mentioned that earlier, and I know you particularly have spent a lot of time working with women with sleep problems. But can you tell us a little bit about sort of gender variation with sleep and what therefore some of the additional challenges that there might be?
So I think it's important to differentiate between gender and sex, and both impact sleep. Sex is biological, right? And that's the biological makeup of men and women are different. Women have the hormonal cycle, the menstrual cycle. I mean, you know, there's pregnancy, there's menopause. All of these are known to impact sleep, you know, particularly, you know, as women go through the perimenopause and even postmenopausal, we see changes in sleep. And that is to do with the fluctuating hormone levels. But that's also maybe to do with increased levels of or perceived levels of stress. There's anxiety, there could be other health issues. Then there is normal biological aging that we all go through. That's known to impact sleep. So there's a lot going on. And then we have gender, and that can sort of be superimposed on the biological sex issues. We have gender and very much the gender norms. And for example, if it is a heterosexual couple with children, it is still, and even in the most progressive relationships, the mother who is the one taking the lion's share when it comes to looking after the children, when it comes to getting out of bed at night or finishing the chores and so on and so forth. So there is a lot of pressure that is put on women, and that women sort of feel they are being put under. That has to do with, yeah, gender. And so that then comes, like I said, is an interplay with the biological factors.
And do you find that some of these things that occur when, for example, there's a family with young children get set into patterns that then continue on beyond the time when, for example, the children are sleeping through the night? Are you sort of setting certain sleep patterns that then are hard to get out of?
Yeah, setting certain sleep patterns. For what I do see is quite often that mothers come to me who have little children, and in the beginning, baby is being the baby, you know, wakes up during the night and so on and so forth. So there's a disruption, but then that baby or toddler sleeps well, sleeps through the night, and suddenly mum keeps waking up at night. And that could be because it's a pattern that sort of she has fallen into. It could be other worries that sort of show themselves at night because the day is so very busy with looking after the child, maybe, you know, running a job as well. So juggling both of these, that then only leaves the nighttime for the brain to process, you know, the day or what's coming up next on the agenda. And like I said a moment ago, the brain doesn't switch itself off when we sleep. There's a shift in attention from outwardly, you can say it's inwardly. The thinking is still happening, not as clear as it is right now, but it's happening. And that is impacting on the body, right? What we think about has an impact on the body. Whether we notice it is a different question, but it's happening. And that can often happen for mums or, yeah, mums of young children or even then older children, you know.
And I certainly know that, well, from just common experience, if you're worried about certain things or if you're stressed about certain things, you can then wake up at night because your brain is turning those things over. I'm just interested. I mean, I was going to ask the why question. Why, as your brain is working these through things through when you're sleeping, does it get to the point where you wake up? What's going on there that causes that change from your brain working on something in a sleeping thing to deciding that you need to wake up. I don't quite understand what's happening.
Yeah, why the urgency? So one thing I didn't mention early on when I was talking about the different sleep stages, I said we're cycling through them. And a cycle is about 90 minutes to 120 minutes. And it's very much going into light sleep, into deep sleep, briefly into light sleep, up into REM sleep. And then we wake up for a short amount of time, usually a few seconds. It's almost like turn around over to the other side, you know, check everything is safe. And then we fall asleep again. We do the same thing, light, deep, light, REM, briefly wake up. Now, these wake ups, it could be that the brain, the worrying brain, the anxious brain, the thinking brain is hijacking these natural awakenings and is like, let's use that time. Because in the middle of the night, there's no one, you know, putting any demands on us. It's just us and our mind. And our mind is right. And now you're mine. Now I get your full attention, right? And then all that thinking is taking place.
I'm just going to take you in a different direction now, because all of this is blowing my mind. It's really fascinating. One of the things you mentioned about was age. And I can sort of understand, obviously, children go through a certain phase, and that's fine. But what's happening at different phases and ages of a life that changes our sleep patterns?
Another very good question. And we have ideas, but there's still lots more to discover. The research field of sleep, as well as circadian rhythms or chronobiology, are relatively young compared to other disciplines. So we know the body itself ages, right? Different various processes. We know aging has an impact on the body clock. So this area that I mentioned in the brain, it's about 50,000 cells. We know there are structural changes happening. That means that's the sort of one of the theories that the output, the signal this clock is giving to the rest of the body aren't as strong or maybe not as regular. And in fact, my PhD looked at sleep in older people. In that instance, older was anyone over 65, and looking at people with sleep problems and looking whether more light exposure during the day, and in particular blue enriched light, would improve their sleep. And the idea there was that light, but particularly blue enriched light, would strengthen sort of the clock and the output of the clock. So help the clock to provide clearer, more regular signals. So that could be one way why we experience more poor sleep. Then any kind of health issues, and they don't need to be big issues, but pain is a big one. Any kind of chronic disease can have an impact on sleep. Then sedentary behavior, right? Compared to children, adults sit much more. As we get older, we sit again more because maybe we've got joint pain and so on and so forth. So that can be another route into poor sleep. Then we have mental health and conditions such as depression, anxiety. They go hand in hand with poor sleep or with insomnia. Which one comes first? Different for different people. So there's a lot that's happening there.
I think one of the messages I'm getting from you is something that we know instinctively but kind of forget in our day-to-day lives, which is this link between the body and the mind. And you know, we're a physical body and the brain does certain things, but it is all linked as a system, and perturbations here can have effects over there in a strange sort of way. One of the other things that I'm sort of picking up is that there's a huge amount of active research on how certain things change, but there's still a lot that isn't known about why certain things change, which must make it a really interesting area to work in.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that I find fascinating, or just amazes me every time, we all have something to say on this topic of sleep and circadian rhythms, right? Because we all sleep, whether it's good or bad, short or long, we all have an experience that we, you know, can relate to or bring into the conversation. So it is different, slightly different, sometimes vastly different between people. And that's what I find so fascinating, and how you assess it. When you asked early on about sleep quality, sleep generally, how you assess it. So there's a couple of studies that have brought people into the sleep lab, hooked them up with electrodes to measure the brain waves, and then to say, are they asleep and which stage? And when these volunteers had fallen into the lighter sleep stages, they were woken up. And the researchers asked them, what do you think? Have you been asleep or not? And the vast majority said, no, we hadn't been asleep. But objectively measured, right, with electrodes, they were asleep, but their perception was a different one. Now, which one is right, which one is wrong, right? It depends how you come at it. So that's what I say. It's so fascinating. The experiences are so rich.
Yeah, no, I mean, it sounds very exciting. I wanted to ask you about a different area because I know you've worked with shift workers, and shift workers are an interesting group because, of course, they are deliberately working at a time when most of us are sleeping and sleeping at a time when most of us are awake. And what have you found? How does that affect them and their brain function and their sleep and so on?
And sometimes their family. So first of all, I'm in huge awe of anyone who is working night shifts or even late shifts, because I'm certainly not a late person. For me, going to bed late or staying up the night is tremendously hard. So to do that again and again, sometimes permanent, but that's rare. Usually it's a cycle of maybe 3 nights, 4 nights, 7 nights. It depends on the operation. Like I said, I'm in awe and I'm incredibly grateful to any shift worker, particularly, emergency services and the police. What have I found? Well, again, there is no one size fits all prescription, not for people, but also not within an industry. So it's really, you have to look at the operation in front of you, what's going on there, to make any recommendations. Having said that, we do know that, the risk of fatigue, the risk of feeling tired, falling asleep is very high, sort of during the night, in the second half of the night, first half of the night. That's very common, and that increases the longer you are on shift. So what for me really was a takeaway when I worked with the different companies is to talk to people, to talk to the employees and hear from them their experience. What are they struggling with and what do they find helpful? And some found it helpful that when they came home in the morning after a shift, to maybe have a light breakfast, but then go to bed as soon as possible. And then there were others, smaller group, but nevertheless, they said, no, actually, I try to stay up a little bit and I go to bed a little bit later in the morning. So, different approaches. Something else that also came through is what gets in the way of getting sleep during the day, because that is naturally hard for most of us. It is really hard to get sleep in the day. So you need the quiet, cool, dark environment. Now, if the shift worker were living on an island, relatively easy to achieve, but my shift workers live in a community that could be on site, still a community, or maybe even at home. And so it's the environment, family, neighbors, something like that. They also, in a way, play a role. They have indirectly, directly an influence on the ability of that person to sleep. So it's to consider sort of the wider environment, not just the single person in front of you.
And are there long-term effects of shift work, or are these things related to the few days around which you're shift working, but a little bit like jet lag, you can readjust and carry on?
No, they are long term. So there is shift work disorder. So the long term effects, that's what I wanted to say. There's shift work disorder. We see that with shift workers, that has an impact, a negative impact on weight, on the risk of diabetes, glucose, insulin levels. So there is a whole range of stuff that's going on. There could be potentially an increased risk of cancers. I'm not too sure how clear the data is. Certainly, evidence suggesting that. Because shift workers get less sleep than a daytime worker. And that is because, as I said a moment ago, we human beings, we find it hard to sleep during the day, right? That is naturally hard because we are designed, if that's the right word, to sleep at nighttime and to run around, get food, and so on and so forth when it's light outside, right? And we can work against this to some degree, but it takes a lot of effort. And that takes its toll on health and well-being, and I think relationships as well in some instances.
Yeah, I can certainly see how it would take a toll. We've been talking about science. We've been talking about how exciting it is. And we were saying a little bit earlier that there are still quite a few unknowns. And I'm just asking you to sort of look forward a little bit over the next few years. What are some of the things that we don't know about sleep that are sort of current areas of research that are sort of we might see some progress on in the next 5, 10, 15 years?
I think where we will see progress is a better understanding how sleep disrupted circadian rhythms and health issues, particularly mental health issues, how they relate. We know there's an association, but I think understanding the mechanisms better, and then what can we do? What can we do to stabilize the rhythms? What can we do to improve the sleep, to minimize the risk of mental health disease, or even re reverse that? So I think that's one. I think we will also get better at being able to measure circadian rhythm within a person. And I'm thinking here of personalized medicine, something like personalized, advice on circadian health. So for example, I mentioned larks and owls early on, early people, as in early to bed, early up, late people. This shift in rhythm, early to late, or the difference, I should say, that's not just in the sleep-wake behavior. That is also in the eating behavior. That's potentially in anything related to exercise and so on and so forth. So finding out when is the best time for a lark compared to an owl to exercise, and then also looking at the sexes. Right, because we know there's a difference between men and women. We know we will probably, hopefully, find out light sensitivity. We know how sensitive people are varies between people and within one person, depending on clock time, and potentially again a difference between sexes. So just finding out when is one most sensitive, least sensitive, and how can that be used again to stabilize the clock, improve sleep. So that's kind of what I'm seeing, waiting, hoping for.
Fantastic. That's certainly an exciting prospect to get some more of those lessons and information. We're sort of coming to the end of our time, but I can't go without asking you one obvious question, which is really, so given what we all know now, on average, what are the kind of advice that you give to people who are actually struggling to sleep?
Yeah, what advice do I give? So sort of the nutshell advice. One is about keeping sleep times regular, finding out when are my sleep times, not sort of what is society's norm or what is my bed partner doing. It's more what are my sleep times. Looking at what's going on in the day, because sleep and wake, day and night, they influence one another, right? So what I do during the day, I mentioned sedentary behavior, stroke exercise, light exposure, eating, drinking, and when. All of that will have an impact on our sleep. And of course, stress levels, worrying about stuff, hectic, busy, fast-paced lifestyles. All of that is likely to going to have an impact on sleep. And so is the slow lifestyle as well. So looking, how is this impacting? And then seeing where can I make changes, and where can't I make changes? Because some things we just can't change. But is there something within my attitude or my approach that I can change? Or can I say, yeah, I'd love to make a change. It's not possible. That's how it is right now. Will it be like this forever? Who knows? I can't foresee the future. But right now, and in that sense, helping you to become in one way or another more grounded and calmer. Because that's ultimately what I'm interested in. I am a biologist. That's my first training. And so really that arousal or hyperarousal that many of us carry, in particular people with insomnia, how can we re reduce that without forcing relaxation to happen? That's kind of, it's a long-winded answer, I think, but at the end of the day, it's about helping you feel calmer within yourself.
Fantastic. Well, there we will have to stop because we've run out of time, but some really helpful advice there. Dr. Katarina Liddell, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, you've been listening to the podcast from the Foundation for Science and Technology. My guest this week was Dr. Katarina Liddell, sleep therapist and author of Sleep Sense. This podcast is produced by the Foundation for Science and Technology. You can find details of all our work, including our events, our journal, our Future Leaders program, and all previous editions of this podcast on our website at www.foundation.org.uk. Until the next time, goodbye.